think as long as we understand that I'm sitting up here, and when you're looking at me, you're seeing you. I'm sitting here looking at you, seeing me, then it's probably okay to go ahead and have a Dharma talk. Otherwise, it might get a little weird. As sometimes happens when I was coming in, followed by my brave incense holder, I want to be honest, I was thinking, God, this is ridiculous. It really is. It's also kind of pretty in a way. But it's also ridiculous. And ridiculous things are, it's not like they're bad necessarily. And if they're helpful, then so much the better. Then they can be both ridiculous and helpful. So sometimes a certain way of training our body mind to be a little bit formal just reminds us to keep letting the light turn back, as Dogen says. It's really all it's for. And if it's, if it becomes a pageantry for its own sake or something like that, then the ridiculousness goes way up and the helpfulness goes way down. And then it makes it harder for us to recognize the truth in our own body that when you look at me, you're seeing you, and vice versa. So we need to be careful about that in the midst of our kind of yogic pageantry. Last week was kind of busy. A week ago, Thursday, I made an unscheduled visit to the hospital up there, up the hill, Davies, via ambulance. Because it kind of looked like I was having a stroke. Turned out not to be. But it was sort of interesting. Some of you know I sometimes have migraine headaches, and this was kind of a bad one. And sometimes when they're bad, I get very sick to my stomach, which I was. And without going into too much detail, boring you with my own karmic particularities, this kind of nausea associated with a migraine can arise very fast. So, having had this experience before, I was up in my room there and I felt like, okay, the piano is now falling from the fourth story and I'm standing under it, so I better get moving here. So I leapt for my door, only to find that the upstairs bathroom was occupied, which not infrequently is. So I galloped downstairs, just made it to the John down here on the back porch, and then, having performed what I had to perform there, I couldn't stand up. And the house was spinning in a way that I had never experienced. I could not sit upright. So I thought, oh, this is really weird. So I crawled into the kitchen. Luckily, resident Michael was having breakfast and I weakly called for assistance. And there were some other people too present, and Jennifer performed the healing touch, which was very helpful. Thank you. It was you, right? Because I couldn't see who was behind me. And Bruce was there and some other people. And so they hauled me off to the hospital, where pretty much the doctor and the nurse were like, what are you doing here? I'm so embarrassed, you know. Apparently I had misapplied my blood pressure medicine, and the way that collided with the migraine contributed to a sharp drop in blood pressure. So it wasn't anything that dramatic, but it really felt like a stroke. So I thought, well, this is interesting. This might be, as they say, it. And one thing I wanted to report on was that it wasn't that scary. And I was surprised because I, if you think about stuff like that in the abstract, it seems like it must be very scary. But it's not like there wasn't fear present, but the fear was not very significant. And what was absorbing was the way phenomena were unfolding in this remarkable, unpredictable way that I had never experienced. And also to have, well, there's, you know, Sangha around me here. And if this is it, this is fine. This is a fine way to go. And I realized, you know, I really had the Buddha Dharma to thank for that. For instead of being like totally like freaked out and foaming at the mouth and calling for mommy and all that stuff, which I guess could also still happen. But in this instance, it was pretty clear that, and I'm not saying this because like I'm this great Dharma practitioner, I'm saying it because the Dharma is pretty cool. And Dharma actually affects these changes in us such that when phenomena we even haven't encountered before arise, there's a little bit of an eye opening into birth and death with change, which changes the experience. So that, as the Heart Sutra says, you know, the Heart Sutra says, the mind will be without hindrance, and without hindrance, there is no fear. And I believe that what it means is that even if there is fear, it will not hinder us. This is, I believe, what the Heart Sutra is talking about. So this, I thought this was very encouraging, you know, to see Dharma working kind of according to what the Buddhas and ancestors have taught, based on the instructions that we've received and the practice we've done. I thought this is really good. You know, this is what encourages us in our practice when we see that our effort and our, if you like, faith, although we have to be careful about using that word in the West, in what the Buddhas and ancestors have taught is verified. So I thought that this is really good. So I thought I'd just mention that and say, please continue with whatever your practice is, because you will not regret it, ever. Right? You will find that the Heart Sutra just says, without any hindrance, there's no fear, that it's not kidding. And you'll see that for yourself. So that's pretty good. And since that wasn't it, I'm here to tell you today about it. And then, you know, tomorrow might be it, in which case, at least I've said this thing. And so that's good. You know, maybe I earned some of my rice that way. Also, when I left, kind of slinking out, it's like, God, this was embarrassing. You know, I wasn't even dying, and I had to take an ambulance, and now they want $2,000 for a 10-minute trip in a car. It's like, ugh, why did I do that? So I kind of went slinking out and got a taxi cab because I wasn't going to call anybody, not at that point. And they gave me a bag with, I'd actually had to have this bowl to throw up in. So they put the bowl in the bag and gave me this bag. It's like, there's your stuff. And the bag said, patient belongings. And I thought, I was a little foggy, so I thought, that's kind of cool. That's our practice. Patient belongings. And I thought, oh wait, that's not what they mean. But in fact, I thought, that's actually our practice. We have this practice of patient belonging, which is called Zazen, where you don't do anything but sit there and kind of patiently belong, rather than try to manipulate our belonging, which we often try to do. And I'm certainly as guilty of that as anybody. It's very easy to wander through this world feeling kind of alienated. And me growing up as a first a introverted, bookish, kind of sissy kid, and then as a gay man, I had a lot of experience of alienation. And so consequently, there was a lot of, Richie, would you mind? I'm sorry. There was a lot of effort to make belonging happen. Various ways, connecting with relationships, or, you know, trying to get my neurotic family to work right, which it wouldn't, or you know, in my studies or work life or whatever it was, trying to get them. And I didn't realize that belonging is cultivated in patience all by itself. Right? It's not something you make happen. It's something that is revealed in the cultivation of patience. Whether it's sitting or standing or walking or chanting, whatever you do, to yogically harness this body mind in such a way that the belongingness of the universe starts to dawn in our own consciousness is pretty great. And just so happens that that belongingness is of a sort that illuminates Buddha's teaching about no fixed self. So again, it's really cool when, you know, Buddha or somebody says something, and then in your own practice you see, my God, that's right. It's totally amazing. These guys weren't just blowing smoke. Well, maybe a little bit of smoke, but mostly that was to help people and to kind of get them hooked, you know, so that they had no choice but to continue their practice. Just like, what's his name, you know, Carlos Castaneda. I suppose that was all totally made up, but I don't know. But anyway, it was pretty cool the way Don Juan, you know, he got Carlos to attack this bruja so that then she would try to kill him and he would have to learn sorcery to defend himself. That was very clever, you know. It was a great story where he tries to get Carlos to take this, what was it? It was like a deer horn. And, okay, now you go and stab that bruja with this deer horn. And she like sees him coming, she's sort of grinning, you know, and he goes, yeah. And next thing he knows, she's on the other side of the street grinning at him. He's like, uh-oh. And Don Juan is like, quick, quick, get back in the car. And they're driving off, and Don Juan's laughing. And Carlos is like, what are you laughing at? And he's like, oh, now you're really in trouble. She's going to come after you. And you have to learn how to practice in order to take care of yourself. So sometimes the Buddhas and ancestors trick us a little bit like that and get us hooked by, you know, saying things like, you know, if you practice, luminous adamantine states of body mind will dawn, and you will be like a god, and you will see past, present, and, you know, all this stuff which you read about in the Mahayana Sutras. And it's not untrue, it's just that the way it's true is not what's apparent on the surface. And as you practice, you begin to realize the unfolding universe they're describing is your own. But you see it and experience it in terms of your own actual life and karma. So whatever those lights and consolations are, they will be your own and illuminated as your own truth, not someone else's. And again, Buddha said this. He wasn't trying to pass his truth on to other people. He was saying, find your own. And, well, here's how, or here's one way. And one way we do that is we cultivate patient belonging. And we just sit still without any particular agenda. And then we notice how tricky that is because we're constantly manipulating stuff. And then eventually we notice what a relief it is to stop doing that. And to allow the body's yogic integrity, which is enormous and powerful, just to be as it is. And to be ourselves, as various teachers have said it, just be yourself. And keep studying that, because it's not how it looks, first of all. Most of the time, what we're trying to do is some sort of fabricated, cooked-up thing that we think is being ourself. But the actual being ourself is one that you almost you can't see it. It is so natural and integral as our being, you can't actually see it. So if you see yourself, oh, hey, now I'm being myself, probably not. Right? You can just let that go. Right? And when you're actually being yourself, it's just like there's a kind of belonging that you will not be able to grasp, but you will know is there. Right? Mostly that kind of belonging I was talking about looking for before is a kind that I was trying to get a hold of. But this belonging is shared with all beings and therefore can't be grasped. It simply is. And it is now, and it is when you're sleeping and when you're walking around or whatever you're doing. And the truth of that, the inescapable truth of that, becomes evident as we practice. So that's kind of what we're doing here. And I'm sorry it's so ridiculous some of the time. But there's a long history of this ridiculousness, as you may know, going back many, many, many centuries, millennia even. Human beings have been kind of into ridiculousness because they also found that it can be helpful to kind of exteriorize our ungraspable, ineffable inner experience in a way that we can kind of admire and play with it and dance with it and so forth. It's actually kind of helpful. So in Zen, it's sometimes the ridiculousness is kind of amped up a little bit and packaged in a certain particular theatrical way that really is kind of stupid and sometimes kind of violent sounding. And yet also can be striking in its naturalness and innocence. One of the ways they talk about Zen practice places is kind of like a forest. So this image of the forest is a common one, and Suzuki Roshi's temple in Japan, as you know, Rinso in means like a forest person temple. So it's the person of the forest, and sometimes the hall where people sit is likened to a forest of trees, just kind of sitting there still, and as the breeze gently wafts in and out. So one day, capitalizing on this forest motif, the great Master Linji was somewhere near the monastery, and he had a hoe, so he was kind of digging up the ground, and there were some saplings around that apparently he was planting. And his teacher, Wangbo, came by and saw him and said, so why are you planting these trees out here in the mountains? And Linji said, well, I'm creating a good environment for the temple and a landmark for future generations. And Wangbo kind of scowled at him and said, that may be so, but you will not escape 30 blows of my staff. Meanwhile, Linji is hoeing. So then he strikes the ground three times with his hoe and sighs aloud. And Wangbo approves. So this is an extraordinary demonstration of spirit and innocence on the part of Linji, who's like, you know what? Bug off, you tiresome old man. I have work to do. And take your staff with you. His being himself was so striking that his teacher just said, oh, okay, sorry, I'm out of here. And this being ourself is precisely the phenomenon of Zazen in action. It's precisely what is cultivated by our non-grasping, heroic, simple sitting. Or whatever other practice we have, chanting and so forth, freeing captive animals, whatever it is you do, done in that spirit, with that mind, it's the same. So we're kind of, in our humble way, planting trees here to have a nice environment for the temple and for future generations. And it's kind of ridiculous, and yet we keep just hoeing the ground, even when people come along and say, this is so ridiculous, I'm not even going to give you any money. It's like, we sigh aloud and keep hoeing the ground. And people want to threaten us, fine. We'd like it a little better if instead they gave us some money so we could buy rice. But in any case, we're going to keep pulling the ground, creating this fine environment for future generations and for ourselves to cultivate our practice of patient belonging and just being ourselves. Usually when I pause like this, it's kind of like kind of near the end of the talk. So if some of you are wondering, when's he going to shut up? It's pretty soon now. But maybe meanwhile, you'd like to make some comment or ask some questions. Please feel free.
Patient belongings, that was a great insight. And
yeah, I was happy I got that bag.
And then the bowl was that you had in the bag was kind of like the monk's bowl.
The monk's bowl. Oh, I didn't think of that. Uh-huh. Yeah, there was something in the bowl. When it seemed like they kind of cleaned it up a little bit, but there was sort of a soggy paper towel sitting in it. When I took the bowl out. So I thought, well, I got something back. So if this is it, you know, I hope I will still trust that belonging, and all of you the same, because for all of us, there will be an it at some point. And we may even have time to say, oh, this is it. In which case, you know, there may be fear, but it need not be a hindrance. And if we've cultivated a little bit the eye of birth and death, we can see through the fear, so to speak, to the belonging, although it's not an object of our perception exactly. It's more like a knowing of our tissues. Our own body knows this. And the fear, it's like, well, okay. That's like Longbow threatening with his staff. You know what? Go away. I mean, it's fine, but I don't need you. This is a great gift to the Buddhas and ancestors and other great figures in human history have passed on to us. As the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which we chanted this morning, says, you've got it now, so please take care. Yes?
Neil, thank you for your talk. I just wanted to say I happened to be one of the people that was around.
Oh, that's right, so you were. I saw you when I was huddled in the ambulance, and there was Jim looking worried, and I thought, well, bye, Jim. Nice knowing you.
It was. I just wanted to say to everybody here that it was really amazing to see the love and concern for you, and also the spirit of the Sangha come together at that moment. So it's really a very touching.
Yeah, I felt held, and I really appreciated that. Please feel free to comment or question. Yeah.
I can't resist.
Please, don't resist.
So if belonging is being ourself, but of course at another level there is no self, and the truth that's revealed, through our practice is the truth of our own universe.
Mm-hmm.
What's your experience of coming to understand that interconnection there? I understand that the self is at a phenomenal level and the non-self is at a fundamental level.
That's one way of putting it. Mm-hmm.
But I am intrigued by the way your talk moves back and forth between the two.
Mm-hmm. Well, to be honest, there isn't much understanding involved, depending how we mean that. And for instance, in Zen texts, you see that word with its various representations in Chinese and Japanese used various ways. But mostly they say, in the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, it says, it's not really reached by feelings or consciousness. So what's that old poem? The Noiseless Patient Spider? It's like a junior high poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes or something. about the spider that keeps throwing this web out to try and hitch on something. And that's what we do. We're constantly throwing a little bit of web out. And the Jivamira Samadhi is saying, you don't need to do that. So this kind of understanding, as I say, is something that the body speaks in its own language and that our consciousness can't really grasp. And that restless attempt to grasp all the time is, in fact, the source of suffering and is unnecessary. And how it's unnecessary is revealed as we cultivate the practice. You see, actually, it's okay just to sit here and not do anything. And that doesn't so much that instructs us as reveals something that is true in a way that our mind can't really mess with very well. Thank heavens. So I guess I'll just put it something more like that. Yes?
The yogic decorum and the pain, the story about the monk hitting the teacher hitting the monk.
Actually, he didn't hit him, he just threatened.
Threatened, yes.
Uh-huh.
It reminded me of when I would have to fly planes as a little kid. I would fly with my brother to meet my father in New York, and I was really scared of riding airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
I'd end up, as soon as takeoff happened, I'd end up on the floor in a little puddle.
Oh, cool. Uh-huh.
But a technique that my brother came up with was, I'm going to hit you really hard in the arm and it'll distract you. And it wouldn't really work,
right.
But it gave me something temporarily insignificant to be angry about.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the formality of Zen practice and how frustrating and ridiculous it can be sometimes.
A useful distraction?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's part of the design. It may function that way for various of us in our particular karmic circumstance, but the function is actually to show us how much is unnecessary. By giving us all sorts of necessary things to do, it helps clarify the stuff that we think that is necessary as a result of our karmic life, body, mind, and separates that from the simple straightforwardness of this kind of yogic practice of formality. It actually helps illuminate the unnecessary rather than distract. It's sort of more like kind of the opposite. It's meant to bring us to this intimate place of practice where there's really nothing to grasp or do, which is exactly why Wang Bo would bother to hit Lin Ji, although by that time there wasn't so much of that between them. Now that particular branch of the family is really into hitting and pinching and pulling ears and yelling and stuff, so they're a little noisy for my taste. But again, the purpose was to remind us of this inescapable present, where there's nowhere else to be. You can't be anywhere other than there. And to bring us back to that over and over again because of the overwhelming momentum of karma takes some little effort. And the way the effort is encoded in Zen is with a certain kind of formality, various observances. And not just in Zen. Most spiritual environments have something like that. So that the onrush of karmic unfolding is cut across by something else. And this creates a space where a different kind of learning is enabled. So, I was going to say, I promise not to hit you, but what if it's really necessary? Probably it won't be. Anyway, I won't hit you hard. Doctor, I can tell you're about to...
I thought it was very intriguing by your discussion of realizing that, although you thought you might be dying, it wasn't as bad as you maybe thought it was.
It was not.
But,
It was not.
Of course, we don't know because you weren't dying, so maybe you
right.
did. But
right.
But,
it could be different.
But I, you know, I mean, to me, I've been thinking lately a lot about how it's the completely normal thing to die, and everyone, you know, who's ever lived has died, and
yes,
you know, you're not in such bad company, and it's not your fault, and you know, you can't, and yet we go around, even, you know, people I work with professionally in a hospital, feel like, well, if someone dies, it's just sort of, it's a failure, and it must be a bad thing. If the patient is afraid of dying, there's nothing really to say because, of course, they're afraid of dying. It's just the most, you can't imagine how scary it is.
Yes.
This patient's going to die. Mm-hmm. And I'm you know, beginning to try to address that. I'm wondering if there's anything short of a lifetime of practice that can help people. There may not.
Well, let's see, a lifetime of practice. I guess. I would say, well, maybe not a lifetime of practice, but the life of practice, which all of you, all of us have, is what will enable us to relate to the sometimes very demanding phenomena of our experience in a way that is different from the impulses of karma. So even if we think, well, we don't have a lot of experience, or we haven't been years in a monastery, wherever it is, the instructions for practice apply to us exactly the same way as someone who maybe did do that, maybe did go off and sit in a cave somewhere. And if we follow those instructions wholeheartedly, the truth of our experience will be revealed, whether we think we're an adept or someone else thinks we are or not. So rather than say this, you know, the impulse will always be to get away from a situation that is intense and difficult. Whether we're just sitting on our cushion, you know, by ourselves, and we're uncomfortable, or some difficult memory coming up, or whatever it is, the impulse is always to get away. And the strength of the practice is in showing us that it's not necessary. You can't get away anyway. And getting away is not even satisfying. In fact, it's the path of suffering. And people can learn that very fast. Well, sometimes you just hear that teaching once, and people start to apply that to their own experience and see, my God, that's right. Yes, madame.
Good day. I was just thinking that's exactly, you know, that was exactly one of the reasons, anyway, that I spent so many years as a hospice volunteer. It wasn't because I thought I had something to give. It was because I wanted to know, so what?
What's up?
What is this? You know,
yeah.
What happens? What,
yeah.
You know, what do people experience?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, you know, sometimes just the environment of hospice is enough,
mm-hmm.
to help people kind of shift into, you know, not trying to get away or
yeah.
not grasping.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people are scared up until the day that they die.
Yeah.
But there's always a moment when, you know, there's always a moment of letting go.
Yes.
Whenever that is.
Whenever that is, exactly.
You know, and so it's just so interesting. It's everybody's got their own process. There's no should about it. It's
That's
just,
right.
You know, it's kind of this...
All karma is unique.
Karmic thing.
Yes.
That, you know, and if the environment is safe and nurturing enough, then it really allows people to, you know, to not have to... You know, do their duty and stay alive, or
right.
you know, something like that.
Be a good person and don't die, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's pretty obvious that we've created an artificial chasm between birth and death, and there's a reason why in so much of our literature, it's presented as one thing. You know, two Chinese characters rubbing shoulders: birth, death. It's one thing. That chasm does not exist. And on some level, I feel like beings know that. And yet, if the movement of the culture is so much to try to pull those two apart and get one away out of sight, the effects are not going to be healthy. And the effect will be to make us afraid of that thing that we've tried to get rid of and hide, even though it's with us all the time. It is inseparable from this very life. And to cultivate practice in that way means that it becomes less and less terrifying, because the thing that's terrifying does not exist. Right? That's an invention of our thinking and supported by our culture, but it does not exist. And to study birth and death as one thing, which is another way of talking about Zazen, is the remedy for this split that we've created. Or anyway, one remedy. You could also get real drunk, but then, you know, that wears off, and then you throw up. So it's like, I wouldn't recommend that path either. Oh, I had not been drinking, by the way. Even though I felt like I had. That was not what was going on. Yes. Well, the short story is I was a miserable and neurotic adolescent, as some are, and I was definitely in that camp. And, you know, I was a gay kid who didn't know it and was dealing with that for years, which was kind of difficult because the pieces just would not fit. I could not figure out why. And the obvious answer was, hey, you're a fag. That didn't dawn on me till I was like 24. And in the meantime, things just wouldn't fit. So I was quite struggling there, and there was no satisfaction available in my religion of upbringing, which was Roman Catholicism. No one could show me what the riches were there. And so I thought, well, the heck with this, I'll just turn my back on it and look for something else. And here was Buddhadharma talking about dukkha, and I thought I knew what Buddha meant by that. Actually, I didn't, but I thought I did. So this is like one of these little tricks. It's like the inescapability of dukkha. It's like, oh man, I know what that is. Man, I'm just miserable, you know? And it's like, that's not what Buddha meant, but it's close enough that I got drawn in. And eventually, when I actually started practicing, this phenomenon of something happening outside of my grasping consciousness was what actually hooked me. And that's when I was like 15 or so, and then started Zazen practice when I was 17 or so, and pretty much daily Zazen practice for about 13 years when I tripped and fell into this abyss that we're talking about, of birth separated from death, and realized that although I was setting myself up to be happy middle-class white gay man with a substantial income, oh, this is going to be fun, I realized I'd left something out. Namely, what about death? And this was in like 1980, 81, and some weird things were starting to happen in our community. And it was like, I swear to God, it was like, what's his name? James Hillman, I think, who or is it Robert Johnson? Who talks about a man's life in terms of the myth of Parsifal. And in that myth, you know, there's a scene where Parsifal is having this great time. He's like a teenage knight, and he's got his armor and everything, and he's like totally cool, and people are, you know, women are throwing themselves at him, and the men are like, way to go, kid. And he's having this big party, and into this party comes this dreadful old hag sitting on a donkey facing backwards. And everybody's like, who let her in? You know, and she proceeds to just lambaste him and said, you fraud, you absolute fraud. You think this is it? Well, guess what? Get back to the beginning of the line, because you are out to lunch. And the whole room, all these hundreds of people who came to admire our teenage knight, look at him and say, you know, she's right, hell with you. And they all walk away. And he's like, but. And then the true study begins. Once all of that great heady success begins to fall away, he realizes, okay, now the real work happens. Now I need to find my way to the Grail Castle. And that's what happened to me in about 1980, whatever it was, 81, 82. The the hideous hag, or the hideous damsel, she's sometimes called, showed up and said, forget it, you left something out. And I went, oh yeah, right. So I ran off to a monastery. And not everyone has to do that, but that's what I did. And it was the thing to do. And the first winter there was hell, absolute hell. I was desperate to get to the Grail Castle, and that's the one way you don't get there, by being desperate. How do you get there? By patient belonging. And that took a while to dawn on me. And this this sort of Western koan, if you like, whom does the Grail serve? You! As they say, the Grail serves the Grail King. Now that's the male myth, and there are female counterparts that are just the same. The Grail serves you. And the approach to the Grail Castle is through, I venture to say, patient belonging, not struggle. Yeah, you could say there's some struggle there, but when you recognize the nature of the struggle, as Suzuki Kyoshi says, all those weeds in the mind, they start to be like, oh, this is like fertilizer. This is wonderful. I can work with this. Pretty amazing. What a mishmash this talk was. Sorry, maybe I should put more ahead here. But thank you all for your questions and for your patient belonging, and please continue your practice.